Hello and welcome along to this week's episode of the Total Fertility Podcast, where we explore the minds of experts from all different walks of life. Our aim is to make your fertility journey just that little bit easier. I'm Ed Coates, a consultant gynecologist, a fertility specialist and co-founder of the website totalfertility.co.uk, where we try to connect you to all kinds of resources that will inform you, empower you and help you on your way to finding your fertility. Now this week, we're talking about metabolic health. We're also going to be thinking about weight loss and how this all filters in and ultimately to optimising our fertility. Our guest today is a dear friend of mine, Dr. Campbell Murdoch, who I've known for a very long time. He's a GP in the southwest of England, but he has a special interest in this area of metabolic health. He's the medical director of Preventative Healthcare Group, which is an organisation really focused on preventing and reversing modern diseases. And Campbell's focus is really about trying to deliver services that help people and empower them to make the right decisions about their metabolic health and make the right choices. And with that, hopefully, we will see results and health improvement. Obviously, the benefits of changing our metabolic health can have an impact on long-term diseases such as type 2 diabetes. But importantly for many of our patients trying to conceive, there is this condition which is well known and talked a lot about, polycystic ovary. So we're going to be touching a little bit on that today and how metabolic health links into polycystic ovaries and fertility. So Campbell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ed. Real pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. It's a privilege to have you joining us on this. This is the 16th episode, so we are motoring through. And we've had some fantastic guests, and that includes yourself. I feel very honoured that you've joined us to give us your wisdom on this. Can I start with a really broad question? Because some people listening to this might have heard of metabolic health, but might not know an awful lot about it. So what is metabolic health, and why is it important?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And metabolic health is a term which is becoming more commonly used, but it's probably the most important health term of our time. And the reason for that is poor metabolic health is the driver for almost all modern diseases. And when I say modern diseases, I'm meaning conditions which, if you went back 100 years, would have been rare, but are now common. And these are conditions such as type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes, fatty liver, dementia, stroke, some cancers, and including fertility problems. The sort of physiology behind that, which I'm sure we can dive into, is really fascinating and links to something called insulin resistance. But the term metabolic health is being increasingly used now to really refer to the physiological state that the body's in, and you might want to think about it as how happy is the body, how easy is it finding to keep everything in harmony, or the biological term homeostasis, keeping things in balance. How easily can it store fuel and access fuel and burn fuel whilst everything is maintaining a good degree of harmony.
So it's about reaching that sort of equilibrium. And how do we know whether we're in good or bad metabolic health? Is there a way, just by sort of looking in the mirror, you can say, I'm in a, or is it body shape? Is it deeper than that? Because we talk a lot about body mass index, don't we, in healthcare, particularly in fertility. It's the elephant in the room that no one wants to discuss, because it is the problem that stops many people getting funding for IVF. But how would you even know if you're in a good metabolic state or not? Yeah.
So there are some simple measures that can be done. Equally, once you understand what somebody who is in good metabolic health looks like, you can actually relatively quickly eyeball people actually and understand whether or not or where their health may be. But the very simple measures that you can do yourself, there's a measure called the string test, which is basically get a piece of string the same length as the height of you, and you have to wrap that round your waist at about the level of your belly button. And if that won't go around your waist twice, that piece of string won't go around your waist twice, then this could indicate poor metabolic health. And the reason that test is used, so it's basically waist to height ratio, and the reason that test is used is poor metabolic health is associated with is contributed to excess weight around the middle. But importantly, we're talking about excess weight around the middle. So that would be fat sort of inside the belly is what we're trying to identify. It is not we're not really thinking about weight or BMI as such. Weight and BMI are not are really not, they're very crude measures. They're good at a population level, but they're very poor at an individual level. Plus, they bring stigma and judgment. Other measures you can look for without doing blood tests are the common signs of somebody being in poor metabolic health is sometimes it's sort of skin not as good as they would hoped it might be. Skin tags are a common problem. So these kind of little bits of skin that sort of hang off the neck and armpits is a sign that there's probably a problem. Some people can get a bit of pigmentation under the armpits and in skin creases. Some people sort of carrying the excess weight around the jaw and snoring with that. And also generally just feeling a bit fed up and fatigued, which obviously can be contributed to by all sorts of things in life. But poor metabolic health, effectively the engine's not running very well. So people will find they're fatiguing mid-afternoon. And as you can imagine with this, and the problem of poor metabolic health is so widespread now, that many people have normalized this and actually don't know what it is to be well, and they've kind of come to accept that this, how they're feeling, how their body's responding is normal, and many of their friends and colleagues will and family will be the same.
Is this a problem that we should be thinking about from a very early age? Because it strikes me, you know, you read in the media and you hear of childhood obesity epidemic this wave that seems to be affecting everyone now here in the UK. We're obviously one of the fattest nations apparently in Europe. Is this an educational thing that we need to be tackling in terms of prevention, or is it not as simple as that? Is it actually a more structural societal change that is required for us to begin to approach metabolic health that is good?
All of the above. however, as a GP, my expertise is really sat with dealing with individuals, and I'm always keenly focusing on what is it that we are in control of and can change, whilst noting that there are other drivers which we don't have any or as much control over. But what can we do? Now, the issue of why poor metabolic health is so widespread, so the data in the US, only 12% of the US adult population are metabolically healthy.
Wow.
And the UK, we won't be quite as bad as that, but we won't be far off. The measures they use to determine if somebody's metabolically healthy or not, which we can dive into in a bit, is some blood test measurements, blood pressure and waist circumference.
Is that how it's monitored then? So is it down to testing? I mean, you can, as you said, there are some visual clues out there, but really you do need some tests, presumably done by people like yourself, GPs out there, to really even get an understanding of whether you're in poor health.
Yeah, so what you're really looking for is something called insulin resistance, which links strongly into polycystic ovary syndrome.
Yes.
which we can discuss in more detail. But the kind of root behind what we call poor metabolic health from a physiology point of view is insulin resistance.
So what is insulin? Because maybe people listening to this have heard of insulin, but might not fully understand it. I know we're both medical, but
so insulin is a hormone. Hormones are messengers released by the body to instruct other parts of the body to do things.
Yeah.
Insulin's main role, when people think of insulin, is to lower blood glucose. So it's very important for our body to maintain a normal blood glucose or blood sugar level. And if our blood sugar level goes up, we have an organ called the pancreas, which in our abdomen, which releases insulin, and that instructs various actions around the body for glucose to be lowered in the blood again. Key ways that insulin will do that, so it will effectively knock on the door of cells, especially the liver, muscle and fat cells, and effectively knocks on the door and tells them, would you mind opening your door? We've got too much glucose in the blood. We'd like you to open the door and let that glucose into you instead of the blood.
Yeah.
Other mechanisms of how insulin works is it tells our liver to stop making glucose. So our liver is an extremely clever bit of kit, and it can actually make all the glucose, all the sugar that we need to survive for our entire life, which is fortunate, otherwise we wouldn't be here if we didn't eat for a day. And obviously if you have too much glucose already in your blood, then you don't want your liver making and pumping out more. Mm-hmm. And also importantly, which we'll come back to, is insulin is also a fat creating and fat storage hormone. So it tells the body to create and store fat. Now, if everything's running really smoothly, if we've got good metabolic health and the body's in this really happy, harmonious state, and we eat something that raises our blood glucose, we'll release a bit of insulin. The insulin will travel around in the blood, knocking on the door of these cells, asking them to open the door. The doors will open very happily, and the glucose will move out of the blood and go into the cells. Glucose level in the blood returns to normal, and insulin level drops again. Everyone's happy, the system's happy, all is well. What is happening to the vast majority of the population now, though, is this: when our blood glucose goes up and we eat something, the insulin's released, but the cells in the liver, in the muscle, and the fat tissues don't want to open their door. And the reason they don't want to open the door is they've already, in effect, overstuffed. So for the cells, they're thinking, well, I know you're asking us to open the door, but we don't want any more glucose, any more sugar inside ourselves, so we're not going to open our door. If that was allowed to remain the case, then we would end up with an extremely high and immediately dangerously high glucose level, which wouldn't be good for our short-term survival. So as a consequence, this reluctance to respond to the insulin is being sensed by the pancreas, and the pancreas basically pumps out a load more insulin to, instead of being a polite tap on the door of cells, it's like a battering ram telling these cells, you will open your door. And then reluctantly these doors open and glucose can move into the cells and blood sugar level goes back to normal. So if you were just measuring blood sugar in people, then you may not know this kind of civil war is taking place in the body, because the glucose is going up and something's happening, it's going back down. And this may look very similar between people that are metabolically healthy and those who aren't. However, in the metabolically unhealthy group, there is massive amounts of insulin being released to maintain a normal blood sugar. And there are many, many, many knock-on consequences of the large amounts of insulin running around the body, not least it driving fat storage and belly fat, which is a really nice way of looking at things, actually, because often people get blamed that they eat too much and that's why they're overweight. But actually, when you start to look at it as a hormonal issue, and it's a body trying to maintain a normal blood sugar as this kind of kingpin. And actually, I should mention, which we've skipped, blood sugar is such a key area of maintaining health and harmony in the body. A normal blood sugar, so in our body we have approximately, as an adult, about 8 pints or 5 litres of blood in our body. And in all of that blood, a normal blood sugar is just 1 teaspoon or 5 grams of glucose. So a very small amount. So in a litre, that would just be 1 gram. And we know that because if we have a nosebleed or we don't taste sweet, sugary fluid. So this amount of sugar needs to be controlled very, very carefully. Now, interestingly, when you haven't just eaten food, your blood glucose is just 7 grams, so just 2 grams or half a teaspoon more, then that could indicate type 2 diabetes. So that's how tightly the body is going to control blood glucose, and it's going to control that with such rigor and such determination that the rest of the body is going to be made to take the hit if we keep challenging our blood sugar.
So type 2 diabetes, which you touch on there, is this moving from a state of normal metabolic health in patients to poor metabolic health, which is related to sugar, which is unable to enter into cells as easily and reflected by changes in insulin sensitivity in the body. Is that fairly accurate then?
It is, but interestingly, you would say type 2 diabetes is really it's a late sign of somebody who's probably been metabolically unhealthy for a long time. Blood sugar control is such a key area that body needs to control. It will do everything it can to not let blood sugar go up. So once blood sugar goes up, which then you can get this diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, I kind of view it a bit like a pressure release valve is blowing.
So it's a bit late by the time you get that sort of diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Because what interests me is what you said there. You can be running with poor metabolic health for years but not necessarily know it. And then, yes, we all pile on the weight and we start to see our waistlines change. And then you suddenly, you know, usually in your fifth decade, get that sort of nudge that you've you know, your waistline is related to type 2 diabetes. And but all these things are reversible, and I suppose that's what interests me. Well, whilst there's a delay perhaps in understanding when poor metabolic health has begun, is the same the case for you know, the delay for us to, if we're going to reverse this, if we're going to tackle it, how long does it take? Because that's one of the most difficult things I have with when I speak to patients, it's particularly polycystic ovaries patients who have that fertility problem. There is with it, as you're I'm sure going to touch on, this metabolic health link, which does tend towards weight gain. How long does it take for the body to, if you start to do the right things, to sort of correct and come back in the other direction?
The lovely thing, and this is why I've ended up focusing my kind of medical career on this, is the changes are very, very rapid.
Wow. Okay.
So
well, that's good to hear.
it's really good to hear. And so, some people take that as they'll continue to abuse their body knowing that they can do something about it later. And other people will take action sooner. But basically, it's never too late. And there's two ways of really looking at this. One is if you're doing something to drive poor metabolic health in your body, and we can come back to these drivers in a bit more detail, actually, which links into your question about kids and things. But if you're doing something to drive that, the body is going to be coping with that in the best way possible. But slowly, and certainly as we age, the coping strategies to mitigate the challenges the body's having to deal with do start to fail to some degree. And we may think of this like an air conditioning unit in a building or in a home. And this, if you imagine a house with massive big windows, sunny day, sun blaring through, and you could put three fires on inside, and the room is heating up to sort of 25, 30, 35 degrees, but you only want this room to be at 20 degrees. So if there's an air conditioning unit on, that air conditioning unit will fire up and it will be working as hard as it can to try and keep that room cool. Eventually, over time, that air conditioning unit is going to start to not be as effective and the room could start warming up. And you might then struggle to maintain a kind of a temperature in the room of 25 degrees. So that's one element, is thinking, right, what do we do about that? Well, what happens if we put some shutters down and we turn the fires off in the room? Well, one, it gives the air conditioning unit a bit of a time for a breather, and maybe the repairmen can come in and repair the air conditioning unit, getting it functioning better. But the other thing is, if you haven't got the sun blaring in the windows anymore, you haven't got the fires burning, then, well, maybe you don't need the air conditioning unit.
Yeah.
And the temperature would rapidly return to where it should be. So linking this into our metabolic health and insulin resistance, if your body's showing signs of problems and you address the drivers for that problem, within days you will start to see physiological benefits, and within 2 to 3 weeks people will start to notice kind of benefits in how they're feeling and what their body's doing. And that's whether you're actually truly reversing the process and getting back to how your body would have been in your teens, or whether it's a case of the system's a bit broken, but as long as you're not going to hammer it day in, day out, it can cope just fine.
So going back to the question at the beginning about children and that, what are we getting wrong to be in this situation, you know, from a metabolic health point of view? Why are we in such poor metabolic health? What's the sort of crux of what we're doing? Is it exercise? Is it foodstuffs? And if it is both, you know, what proportion is one or each to blame?
So I would say 90% of the problem is what we're eating.
Okay.
And it's not about calories, which will be a controversial point for many people and may produce a bit of confusion. So we can discuss that. But it's not about calories, but it is about what we're eating.
Okay.
And what we need to be thinking about is our body, we're designed to survive, and we're designed to sort of survive as long as we don't get damaged by injury or trauma or infection, quite happily and healthily into our 80s and 90s. To do that, to survive until that age with unpredictabilities of what food is going to be available, the body needs to be able to store fuel, and then access that fuel at appropriate times. And we're evolutionary, we're very well adapted to do that. The body also needs to survive kind of today. So it needs to have mechanisms in place that if that blood sugar goes up, we will quickly bring it down so we don't die of consequence of something we've done to ourselves today. Now, what's happened in the last 50, 60 years is our food environment plus our education, really, of what we deem to be healthy and unhealthy from our food has altered hugely away from what is right for our physiology and biology.
Mm.
And a combination of those together with our kind of primitive instincts of what we want to eat and what we're driven to eat has created a perfect storm, which is why we have so much, so many people are suffering from poor metabolic health and all of these conditions that shouldn't exist. The big thing behind this is effectively ultra-processed food, sugar and refined carbohydrate. Mm. The refined carbohydrate basically refers to kind of starchy foods that have been refined. So that'd be breakfast cereals, many of the bread and things we eat now. And as many people may know, starch, and they may remember back to school days, starch is basically, it's made by plants. Plants make sugar. They then stick sugar together to make starch. And then when we eat it, our digestive system breaks the starch back down into sugar. And obviously sugar then goes into our blood, raises our blood sugar level, and that's one problem. And if you're doing that day in, day out and frequently, effectively the body's going to end up struggling. The other real biggie, though, and this I think is what has broken most people, is another sugar called fructose. And fructose, people may know of it or think of it as fruit sugar or natural sugars. Now, fructose is very sweet. It's probably the sugar that we crave the most and we struggle not to go back to if we've had a bit. Evolutionary, we would only have got fructose from ripe fruit and from honey. And ripe fruit happens once a year and is usually up a tree. And honey is surrounded by bees that sting you. But fructose is very, very good at flicking us into being insulin resistant. So fructose on its own will drive specifically our liver to be insulin resistant. So we eat a lot of fructose. That triggers our liver to be insulin resistant. We then need more insulin to make sure our blood sugar stays normal. So the body moves into a real fat storage mode. We've got a brain that lights up and develops habits from fructose. And I don't know if anyone ever gets to go to their haircut or certain shops, but sometimes sweets are put on the counter.
Yeah.
And
certainly for my kids, yeah.
Yeah, and it works, and it's it triggers a habit. It creates a habit loop and a dopamine hit, and will want us to go back for more. And this was great in evolutionary times when that ripe tree is there, you want to drive to keep going back to it and fatten yourselves up. Or if you're going to have to climb up a cliff to access a beehive to get some honey, you need a driver to do that. Unfortunately, with our food environment now, the advent of modern industrial food processing, mass-produced crops, production of high-fructose corn syrup, and the whole food industry surrounding that, these foods are everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So you then start eating those, especially these kind of fructose sugars, which are basically in every single ultra-processed food that's a bit sweet will have fructose in it. And you will drive the body to become rapidly insulin resistant. That then drives high insulin levels as soon as you eat anything that raises your blood sugar. So even any kind of whole grain starchy foods will still raise your blood sugar, but will need massive more amounts of insulin because you're insulin resistant. And you're in this vicious cycle. So we have the kind of our primitive evolutionary biology which has made us survive to today to thank for those drivers to do that, combined with a food environment that is absolutely playing to those primitive drivers. And then you add in sort of it's in the 1950s 1960s this move to say that eating fat is bad for us, and through the 80s and 90s this focus on a low fat high carbohydrate diet is our staple, which when you kind of dive into it, there was limited research to support this thinking. We've ended up with a perfect storm. You then combine that thinking with, well, the reason people are overweight is because they eat too much and don't exercise enough, which is absolutely wrong, in fact. It's not about this calories in, calories out concept. On the face of it makes sense, but actually when you dive into hormones and physiology, it doesn't make sense. So people end up blaming themselves for why they can't lose weight, and they're trying to eat small portions of low-fat food, which is driving constant hunger. And before you know it, people feel like failures. They feel like it's their fault, and they feel hopeless. And it couldn't be further from the truth, actually.
So I think that compounds it for many patients going through a particular fertility journey, which is being unsuccessful, compounded with the constant knowledge that perhaps they need to reduce their weight to perhaps have success. It can be, I mean, the psychological impact of that is huge, I think, for patients. And it's really interesting to hear you kind of break it down at the level you are, because I think it really helps for you to understand. I think one of the most important things when you're trying to change something is to understand why you're doing it, and why, if you do what you do, why that changes the overall outcome. Just being told that you need to lose weight is really not very useful, and we've known that for a long time. With our patients who are struggling to conceive, who might be listening to this, who know that their BMI is high, is it possible to have a raised BMI still be metabolically healthy? Or is it a case that metabolic health is intrinsically linked to this thing that everyone seems to focus on, BMI, body mass index, which essentially is just a numerical crunching of height and weight? Is it about weight? Is it about BMI? Or can we have people with a normal BMI who are still massively metabolically unhealthy?
Yes, absolutely spot on. So BMI and weight are about an individual level are probably one of the worst measures you can use to assess health. Originally, BMI was developed to look at male population averages, and it's been misused now to be used at the individual level. BMI, as you say, it's based on weight and height. So weight, what is weight? Well, weight is how much pressure we're putting down on a set of scales when we're standing on those scales, and that's taking into account our total body, so our bones, our muscles, the fat inside our body, the fat outside our body, all our organs. When we're thinking about metabolic health and linking into that, actually what we're interested in is the inside of our body, sort of our inner health. And if we're going to talk about fat, then actually the fat we're concerned about is the fat that's in and around our organs, not the fat that sits on the outside of our body. So genetically, you'll get some people who are very, very, very good at growing external fat stores, so growing fat under their skin. And this fat isn't actually unhealthy. It's sort of a safe dumping ground for excess sugar, in effect, that gets turned into fat that goes into the body. And if you're genetically kind of blessed in that way, that you can grow external fat stores very easily, then actually your internals will be looked after and things will be running reasonably well. There are other people who are not so good at putting fat on under the skin, and if they follow those exact same behaviors that would drive a kind of a challenge to blood sugar frequently and eating foods that drive insulin resistance, they'll much more quickly develop fat inside the body and become metabolically healthy and unhealthy much faster. And you see this, I mean, you see the different ethnic groups. So South Asians, for example, they need to be looking for type 2 diabetes in people with a BMI of 23, because the much more predisposed to central fat and fat inside the organs. I personally, I don't like any focus on weight. A population level, you can kind of justify it, but at an individual level, I wouldn't pay any attention to it. And also, like, removing that, it's not about weight, it's not about calories, it's about getting the hormones and insulin in the right place. And removing judgment, which I think is a key thing. So weight can come with stigma and judgment. Unfortunately, food is a coping strategy for many people. So if you create a negative judgment around behaviors and the low self-worth that can come with that, and actually food is a coping strategy, you're kind of creating this vicious cycle of failure. Whereas if you remove this idea that weight is not about being greedy or lazy, it's about how your body is processing fuel to try and maintain harmony internally, then let's start focusing on what we can do to in effect lower our insulin levels.
That's great to hear, you know, that different and almost like revolutionary way of looking at it, rather than focusing on the negatives there, which is what so many patients will have told to them about, you know, weight and that body image which we're faced with all the time in the dreadful media that we have to sort of deal with sometimes. Can we talk about polycystic ovaries for a bit? Because, you know, it's a common condition. It affects a lot of patients. There may be some patients listening, some of our listeners in the audience who have this themselves and are perhaps struggling with ovulation. And why is, obviously, weight is bad for being overweight and being insulin resistant and having polycystic ovaries is linked to our metabolic health. Can you explain a little bit more about why there is that link and perhaps why it's so important to fertility and what patients should be thinking about if they do have polycystic ovaries and are struggling with a raised BMI, because that's obviously what everyone tells them.
So that's right. I think I would break this down really, because with the human body, we are a complex system with all sorts of things interacting all the time. And there's often this kind of question around chicken and egg. Is it increased body fat that drives insulin resistance and high insulin levels, or is it high insulin levels drive increased body fat, which then affects the other hormones and polycystic ovaries and fertility? And actually, it's a bit of everything linked in together. The key for me is high insulin is a central piece of the physiology, the way the body is working with polycystic ovary syndrome. It's a central piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And I think it's far more useful area to focus on rather than certainly weight, which is, as we just discussed, is quite crude. And I think that's well understood now. I'm not aware of anyone to argue me against the idea that high insulin isn't a major player in polycystic ovary syndrome. I think the reason we don't talk about it is we rarely measure it, very rarely measure it. But I think if we did, and if it was easy to measure and as visible as weight, we would have been focusing on that as the kingpin for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it's something we can rapidly alter. Now, high insulin will drive other hormonal changes. So in effect, it will drive up the androgens, the testosterone levels available in the blood through a number of mechanisms. And with everything, with anything to do with our health, and when we're trying to make health improvement, you have to think about, well, where can you interfere with the system to achieve improvement? And actually, this high insulin issue is very easy to break into and fix very rapidly. And therefore, and as you know, I'm sure many of you listen to, polycystic ovary syndrome is quite a broad term which will present differently in different people. But actually, if we recognise high insulin is a key part of the jigsaw puzzle, then well, let's work to reduce that. The effect of that is actually, well, if we start fixing one hormone and the rest of the hormones start falling into place, well, maybe fertility might change. Now, with my patients, I would never promise anything.
No.
Equally, I have had patients with polycystic ovary syndrome that didn't want to get pregnant. And if they want to improve their metabolic health, you warn them, if they're not using contraception, that they better start, because they might become pregnant if they're not careful. Equally, I've had patients who, within my NHS practice, who are on their kind of last chance of IVF, and no one has spoken to them about insulin resistance and high insulin levels. And for such a simple concept, now it kind of astonishes me that that hasn't been done. Now, I would never want to promise to somebody, if we address this, you're definitely going to get pregnant. But equally, let's start stacking the odds in your favour.
It's that 1% sort of gain, isn't it, in every little area when you're trying to conceive, that patients are really interested in. And as you're right, you know, this is a really common condition. It affects many people. And it isn't just about, I think a lot of people look at IVF as possibly the solution, but actually there's many things you can do from a preventative point of view that may mean you don't ever need to go down the road of IVF, which is essentially what you're kind of, I think, getting at here.
I think so, yeah. And I think it's probably a bit like preparing the ground for a plant to grow well. It's what can you do? You can kind of go planting seeds, and hopefully some of them might grow. But actually, what can we do to the ground to make it one, easier to plant the seed, and two, if that seed is planted, much greater chance for it to grow. Mm. And it's such a from the science, from the physiology, this insulin resistance hyperinsulinemia issue is such an important topic, such an important aspect of the whole scenario, that it would seem a fundamental piece, whether it's going to assist fertility in general and not need IVF, or whether it's going to increase the chance of successful IVF. It seems central to me to be an area to address.
Yeah, and I mean, you talked a little bit about fructose earlier. I was sort of in my head, I was sort of working out all of the shopping aisles I couldn't go down this evening when I head home tonight, because actually there's a number of them that contain, I mean, the breakfast cereal aisle is huge, isn't it? As soon as you get down the Tesco aisle, it's there. And then you've got the bread aisle and all the cakes, and there's loads of things. But is there sort of nutritional targets that patients with PCOS should be focusing on, say, more than other people have to, because of this metabolic link?
Yeah, I think maybe a way to break this down, and if people have PCOS and want to understand their personal physiology, so something we've not talked about is, what other measures can you take to decide, is your body displaying signs of insulin resistance and high insulin levels? So other than the waist circumference, there's two other very easily available blood tests you can do. Now, these must be fasting blood tests, very important. You want to do these when you haven't eaten or drunk anything other than water for the previous 8 hours. But these are your triglyceride level in your blood. Triglycerides are fats in the blood. These tend to get measured with a standard, when you have a standard cholesterol test, they'll also measure the triglyceride level. And if you're insulin resistant and have high insulin levels, the triglyceride level in your blood becomes higher. Also, with the cholesterol test, actually looking for something called HDL cholesterol. HDL cholesterol is often known as Vertical's good cholesterol. Not quite the right name for it, but that's how people know it. And HDL cholesterol goes low when you have insulin resistance and high insulin levels, so you want that level to be higher. Mm-hmm. It shows a better metabolic health sign. And then the other is blood glucose. So again, what's your fasting blood glucose? If the body's in a happy state, then fasting blood glucose will be normal. If it's not, then it'll be high. And also, other than waist circumference, there's blood pressure. So if you have all those measures done, so it's waist circumference, blood pressure, fasting, what we call, if you're going to ask for it, you'd be asking for fasting lipids, which basically the ones you're interested in is triglycerides and HDL cholesterol, and a fasting glucose test. Now, if those measures are sitting in a range that suggests insulin resistance, then you know, actually, and you've got a bit of excess belly fat, and you may be suffering from some other problems we mentioned around the kind of these signs of poor metabolic health, then you know actually your body has to work hard to maintain a normal blood glucose level if you eat any food that challenges your blood glucose. And when I say work hard, it's got to release more insulin. So if you have a slice of bread and you're metabolically unhealthy and have insulin resistance, your body might need to release 4, 5, 6 times more insulin than somebody who's metabolically healthy to do that. So, and then it's locked in fat storage mode, and that vicious cycle persists. So if you have PCOS and you have other markers of insulin resistance, then you know, well, actually, let's give our body an easier time. Let's stop challenging blood glucose day in, day out, 4, 5, 6 times a day. And the way to do that is certainly cut out the ultra-processed sugary foods. So anything basic that comes in a packet or bottle and is sweet. Also, we weren't designed to eat refined carbohydrate. So this is starchy foods that have been through a food processing unit and can usually sit on a shelf for months on end and still be palatable. So that'd be your cornflakes, most or pretty much every single breakfast cereal, including porridge, pastas, polished white rice, all breads, staples of everyday food, actually. Mm-hmm. Once you're insulin resistant, these are going to give your body a hard time. And then depending on how insulin resistant you are, some people need to kind of cut down on their total carbohydrate intake, so total starch intake. So somebody's very insulin resistant, they need to watch how much starch they're eating in general. Somebody who's kind of just going, who's kind of only borderline insulin resistance, they can probably see quite significant improvements by just cutting out the sugars and the starches. So think of your supermarket analogy, you're absolutely right. Supermarkets have been designed for convenience, for foods that have a long shelf life and relatively cheap to produce, but can sell with a decent markup. So actually when you're shopping, it's back to what people will now call real food, which is strange we have to call it real food. But 51% of the food eaten in the UK now is what we call ultra processed. So this is kind of food that's been taken, smashed to pieces and put back together. Versus real food is food that our great, 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 great ancestors would have recognized as food. It's it's vegetables, it's whole protein sources, whatever you prefer to eat, whether that's fish, meat, poultry, legumes, whatever it is. And it's what you would have got on your high street from your butchers and your grocers. It's what we would have gone out and got our hands on thousands of years ago before industrial food processing, which is all good and well, but our food environment is pretty difficult to navigate and designed to hijack us at every stage. So don't underestimate the challenge that this may pose in day-to-day life.
It's such a big topic and not spoken enough about, actually. And it's so interesting hearing you break it all down into those basic elements, which are fundamental, as you say, going back over 100 years, we didn't have the temptation, the problem in front of us half the time. And that's sort of led to this tide change in the way we live and eat, and our environment does affect us. And actually, for patients going through fertility struggles, it's refreshing to be thinking about something other than fertility, rather than looking at the basic cogs of the body and the fertility system. Actually, we're talking about something completely away from that that can have a beneficial impact, not just in PCOS patients, but listening to you, for everyone. It sounds like this is something that metabolically healthy people will benefit from in all areas of fertility.
Absolutely, and I think the something you've mentioned there, which is really important, is if you're going to make a change, if you're going to change your habits, and certainly if you're going to try and swim against the tide of readily available, tasty, manufactured foods, you need a really important why. If somebody hasn't got an important why of why they want to change their habits, or why they may resist that cake that's screaming at them when they go to buy a coffee from the counter, then you can kind of end up tripping over yourself and feeling like you're a failure. But if you have a kind of a life moment which makes this really important to you, then, and this is maybe with fertility, it's a key time that there's something that's important to you, want to achieve, and you recognize how important that is to you, then actually that's quite a strong and powerful emotional driver. And what I tend to say to my patients as well is changing dietary habits can be tough, but maybe just look at the short term, look at the next 3 to 6 months. Don't think about forever. Think about the changes, and people will, within 2 to 3 weeks, they will be tightening their belt. They'll be suddenly realizing they're not hungry 2 hours after eating breakfast. They'll be thinking, I forgot to eat lunch because I wasn't hungry anymore. This isn't about resisting food. Consciously, it's the metabolism starts to shift, the body starts to being able to burn fat, and with that mood improves and fatigue reduces. People, as you mentioned, that have other consequences of poor metabolic health. So one of my areas of interest is reversing type 2 diabetes. So you start bringing people off medication, which is unheard of. Trained at medical school, you won't stop medication. Blood pressure starts improving. You have to stop blood pressure medication.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it always seemed like a one-way road, didn't it? when we were training as doctors years ago. But you're talking about something which has got a sort of a roundabout at the end, and you can come back down the road if you get it right.
That's right.
It's really, I think that's a nice place to sort of finish, really, because, you've talked about what metabolic health is and how we can potentially change it. But the why is really key, I think, to actually achieving it, and to achieve sustained weight loss and essentially optimize your fertility does require that why. So I think that's a really important thing for people to think about carefully. And of course, the driver to have a baby is hugely important for all patients I've ever had the pleasure of sitting and chatting to. But it's a very personal why that gives you those sustained changes. Thank you, Campbell. It's been really, really great speaking with you. I appreciate you giving your time up. It's an honour to have you come on board. And we'll add some links in our show notes to perhaps some resources and places that if people want to get in touch with you, social media handles, things like that, so that people can find out more about this subject if they'd like to. Is that going to be okay?
That's fantastic, Ed. Thank you. Real pleasure being with you and everyone.
Thank you. Today. Thanks for joining us.